She is a daughter of Eve, and he a son of Adam. So there is no crossing through this country without taking a wound. And every wound, whether it's assaultive or passive, delivers with it a message. The message feels final and true, absolutely true, because it is delivered with such force. Our reaction to it shapes our personality in very significant ways. From that flows the false self. Most of the men you meet are living out of a false self, a pose, which is directly related to his wound. Let me try to make this clear. The message delivered with my wound, my father disappearing into his own battles, was simply this. You are on your own, John. There is no one in your corner, no one to show you the way, and above all, no one to tell you if you are or are not a man. The core question of your soul has no answer and can never get one. What does a boy do with that? First, I became an unruly teen. I got kicked out of school, had a police record. We often misunderstand that behavior as adolescent rebellion, but those are cries for involvement, for engagement. Even after God's dramatic rescue of me at the age of 19, when I became a Christian, the wound remained. As my dear friend Brent said, becoming a Christian doesn't necessarily fix things. My arrows were still lodged deep and refused to allow some angry wounds inside to heal. I mentioned earlier that for years I was a very driven man, a perfectionist, a hard charger, and a fiercely independent man. The world rewards that kind of drivenness. Most of the successful men reading this book are driven. But behind me was a string of casualties, people I had hurt or dismissed, including my own father. There was the near casualty of my marriage, and there was certainly the casualty of my own heart. For to live a driven life, you have to literally shove your heart down or drive it with whips. You can never admit need, never admit brokenness. This is the story of the creation of that false self. And if you ask my wife during the first 10 years of our marriage if we had a good relationship, she probably would have said yes. But if you had asked her if something was missing, if she sensed a fatal flaw, she would have immediately been able to tell you, he doesn't need me. That was my vow, you see. I didn't need anyone. After all, the wound was deep and unhealed, and the message it brought seemed so final. I am on my own. Another friend, Stan, is a successful attorney and a genuinely good guy. When he was about 15, his father committed suicide, stuck a gun in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. His family tried to put it all behind them, sweep it under the rug. They never spoke of it again. The message delivered by that gruesome blow was something like this. Your background is very dark. The masculine in your family cannot even be spoken of. Anything wild is violent and evil. The effect was another sort of vow. I will never do anything even remotely dangerous or risky or wild. I will never be like my dad. How many men live with that vow? I won't take one step in that direction. I will be the nicest guy you ever meet. You know what? He is. Stan's the nicest guy you could meet. Gentle, creative, caring, soft-spoken. And now, he hates that about himself. He hates the thought that he's a pushover, that he won't take you on, can't say no, can't stand up for himself. Those are the two basic options. Men either overcompensate for their wound and become driven, violent men, or they shrink back and go passive, retreating men. Often it's an odd mixture of both. Witness the twin messages sported by young college-age men especially. A goatee which says, I'm kind of dangerous, and a baseball hat turned backward which says, but really, I'm a little boy, don't require anything of me. Which is it? Are you strong or are you weak? Remember Alex, who stood at the door waiting for a daddy who would never return? You wouldn't in a million years have guessed that was his story if you'd known him in college. He was a man's man, an incredible football player, a hard-drinking, hard-living man every guy looks up to. He drove a truck, chewed tobacco, loved the outdoors. He used to eat glass. I'm serious, it was sort of a frat party trick he took on, the ultimate display of dangerous strength. He'd literally take a bite out of a glass, chew it slowly, and swallow it. When he worked as a bouncer for a tough bar, it made a pretty impressive show to get the roughnecks in line. But it was a show, the whole macho man persona. Charles, the artistic boy, the piano player whose father called him a faggot, what do you think happened there? He never played the piano again after that day. years later, as a man in his late 20s, he does not know what to do with his life. He has no passion, cannot find a career to love, and so he cannot commit to the woman he loves, cannot marry her because he is so uncertain of himself. But of course, his heart was taken out, way back there in his story. Dave is also in his 20s now, drifting, deeply insecure, and loaded with a great deal of self-hatred. He does not feel like a man, and he believes he never will. Like so many, he struggles with confidence around women and around men he sees as real men. Stuart, whose father abandoned him, became a man without emotion. His favorite character as a boy was Spock, the alien in Star Trek who lives solely from his mind. Stuart is now a scientist, and his wife is immensely lonely. On and on it goes. The wound comes, and with it, a message. From that place, the boy makes a vow, chooses a way of life that gives rise to the false self. At the core of it all is a deep uncertainty. The man doesn't live from a center. So many men feel stuck, either paralyzed and unable to move, or unable to stop moving. Of course, every little girl has her own story, too. But I want to save that for a later chapter and bring it together with how a man fights for a woman's heart. Let me say a few more words about what happens to a man after the wound is given. Chapter 5, The Battle for a Man's Heart. Now you're out there, God knows where. You're one of the walking wounded. Jan Christ from The Walking Wounded by Jan Christ and Paul Murphy. To give a man back his heart is the hardest mission on earth. From the movie Michael. Nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. Bruce Coburn, Lovers in a Dangerous Time. A few years ago now, my middle son, Blaine, made the big transition to first grade. That's a huge step for any child, leaving the comfort and safety of mom's side, spending all day at school, being among the big kids. But Blaine's a very outgoing and winsome boy, a born leader, and we knew he'd handle it swimmingly. Every night at the dinner table, he regaled us with tales of the day's adventures. It was fun to recall with him the joys of those early school days. A shiny new lunchbox, brand new yellow number 2 pencils, a box of Crayolas with a built-in sharpener, a new desk, and new friends. We heard all about his new teacher, gym class, what they played at recess, how he was emerging as a leader in all the games. But then one night he was silent. "What's wrong, Tiger?" I asked. He wouldn't say, wouldn't even look up. "What happened?" He didn't want to talk about it. Finally, the story came out. A bully. Some first-grade poser had pushed him down on the playground in front of all of his friends. Tears were streaming down his cheeks as he told us the story. "Blaine, look at me." He raised his tearful eyes slowly, reluctantly. There was shame written all over his face. "I want you to listen very closely to what I am about to say. The next time that bully pushes you down, here's what I want you to do. Are you listening, Blaine?" He nodded, big wet eyes fixed on mine. "I want you to get up, and I want you to hit him as hard as you possibly can." A look of embarrassed delight came over Blaine's face. Then he smiled. Good Lord, why did I give him such advice? And why was he delighted with it? Why are some of you delighted with it, while others are appalled? Yes, I know that Jesus told us to turn the other cheek, but we have really misused that verse. You cannot teach a boy to use his strength by stripping him of it. Jesus was able to retaliate, believe me, but he chose not to. And yet we suggest that a boy who is mocked, shamed before his fellows, stripped of all power and dignity, should stay in that beaten place because Jesus wants him there? You will emasculate him for life. From that point on, all will be passive and fearful. He will grow up never knowing how to stand his ground, never knowing if he is a man indeed. Oh yes, he will be courteous, sweet even, deferential, minding all his manners. It may look moral, it may look like turning the other cheek, but it is merely weakness. You cannot turn a cheek you do not have. Our churches are full of such men. At that moment, Blaine's soul was hanging in the balance. Then the fire came back into his eyes, and the shame disappeared. But for many, many men, their souls still hang in the balance because no one has ever invited them to be dangerous, to know their own strength, to discover that they have what it takes. I feel there is this stormy ocean within me, and I keep trying to make those waters calm and placid, confessed a young friend in his early 20s. I would love to be dangerous, he said, sighing. You mean it's possible? I feel like I have to ask permission. Why on earth would a young man have to ask permission to be a man? Because the assault continues long after the wound has been given. I don't mean to create a wrong impression. A man is not wounded once, but many, many times in the course of his life. Nearly every blow ends up falling in the same place, against his strength. Life takes it away, one vertebrae at a time, until in the end, he has no spine at all. I read a case a few years ago about a baby boy who suffered a terrible blow during his surgery. His penis was accidentally removed. The event took place back in the 70s, and a decision was made that reflected the widely held belief that sex roles are not truly part of our design, but merely shaped by culture and therefore interchangeable. His genitalia were reconstructed in female form, and he was raised as a girl. That story is a parable of our times. It is exactly what we've tried to do to boys, starting from when they are very young. As Christina Hoff Sommers says in her book, The War Against Boys, it's a bad time to be a boy in America. Our culture has turned against the masculine essence, aiming to cut it off early. As one example, she points to the way in which the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, are being used against boys in general. Most of you will remember the tragic story from April 1999. Two boys walked into the school library and began shooting. When it was all over, 13 victims and their two assailants were dead. Sommers is alarmed by the remarks of William Pollack, director of the Center for Men at McLean Hospital, and so am I. Here's what he said. The boys in Littleton are the tip of the iceberg, and the iceberg is all boys. The idea, wildly held in our culture, is that the aggressive nature of boys is inherently bad, and we have to make them into something more like girls. The primary tool for that operation is our public school system. The average school teacher faces an incredible challenge to bring order to a room of boys and girls and promote learning. The main obstacle to that noble goal is getting the boys to sit still, keep quiet, and pay attention for an entire day. You might as well hold back the tide. That's not the way a boy is wired, and it's not the way a boy learns. Rather than changing the way we do male education, we try to change males. As Lionel Tiger reports in his book, The Decline of Males, boys are 3 to 4 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed as suffering from attention deficit disorder. But maybe they're not sick. Maybe, as Tiger says, this may simply mean they enjoy large muscle movements and assertive actions. Boys, as a group, appear to prefer relatively boisterous and mobile activities to the sedate and physically restricted behavior that school systems reward and to which girls seem to be more inclined. Tell me about it. This guy ought to come over to our house for dinner. With 3 boys at the table, and 1 man, but with a boyish heart, things get pretty wild at times. Chairs, for the most part, are an option. The boys use them more like gymnastic equipment than restraints. Just the other night, I look over to see Blaine balancing across his chair on his stomach, like an acrobat. At the same moment, Luke, our youngest, is nowhere to be seen. Or rather, in the place at the table where his head should be, we can only see a pair of socks pointing straight up. My wife rolls her eyes. But not our school systems. As Tiger says, at least 3 to 4 times as many boys than girls are essentially defined as ill because their preferred patterns of play don't fit easily into the structure of the school. Well-meaning psychomanagers then prescribe tranquilizing drugs for ADD, such as Ritalin. The situation is scandalous. The use of drugs so disproportionately among boys betrays the failure of school authorities to understand sex differences. The only disease these boys may have is being male. But it's not just the schools. Many of them, by the way, are doing a heroic job. How about our churches? A young man recently came to me very angry and distraught. He was frustrated at the way his father, a church leader, was coaching him in sports. He's a basketball player, and his team had made the city finals. The night of the big game, as he was heading out the door, his father literally stopped him and said, "Don't go out there and kick butt. That's just not a nice thing to do." I'm not making this up. What a ridiculous thing to say to a 17-year-old athlete. Go out there and give them, well, don't give them anything. Just be nice. Be the nicest guy the opposing team has ever met. In other words, be soft. That is a perfect example of what the church tells men. Someone I read said the church may have a masculine exterior, but its soul has turned feminine. Emasculation happens in marriage as well. Women are often attracted to the wilder side of a man, but once having caught him, they settle down to the task of domesticating him. Ironically, if he gives in, he'll resent her for it, and she in turn will wonder where the passion is gone. Most marriages wind up there. A weary and lonely woman asked me the other day, "How do I get my husband to come alive?" "Invite him to be dangerous," I said. "You mean I should let him get the motorcycle, right?" "Yep." She shrank back, disappointment on her face. "I know you're right, but I hate the idea. I've made him tame for years." Think back to that great big lion in that tiny cage. Why would we put a man in a cage? For the same reason we put a lion there. For the same reason we put God there. He's dangerous. To paraphrase Sayers, we've also paired the claws of the lion cub of Judah. A man is a dangerous thing. Women don't start wars. Violent crimes aren't, for the most part, committed by women. Our prisons aren't filled with women. Columbine wasn't the work of two young girls. Obviously, something has gone wrong in the masculine soul, and the way we've decided to handle it is to take that dangerous nature away. Entirely. We know that our society produces a plentiful supply of boys, says Robert Bly, but seems to produce fewer and fewer men. There are two simple reasons. We don't know how to initiate boys into men. And second, we're not sure we really want to. We want to socialize them, to be sure, but away from all that is fierce and wild and passionate. In other words, away from masculinity and towards something more feminine. But as Summer says, we have forgotten a simple truth. The energy, competitiveness, and corporal daring of normal, decent males is responsible for much of what is right in the world. Summers reminds us that during the Columbine massacre, Seth Huey threw his body over a terrified girl to shield her from the bullets. 15-year-old Daniel Roberg paid for his life when, at mortal risk to himself, he held a door open so others could escape. That strength so essential to men is also what makes them heroes. If a neighborhood is safe, it's because of the strength of men. Slavery was stopped by the strength of men at a terrible price to them and their families. The Nazis were stopped by men. Apartheid wasn't defeated by women. Who gave their seats up on the lifeboats leaving the Titanic so that women and children could be saved? And have we forgotten? It was a man who let himself be nailed to Calvary's cross. This isn't to say women can't be heroic. I know many heroic women. It's simply to remind us that God made men the way they are because we desperately need them to be the way they are. Yes, a man is a dangerous thing. So is a scalpel. It can wound or it can save your life. You don't make it safe by making it dull. You put it in the hands of someone who knows what he's doing. If you've spent any time around horses, you know a stallion can be a major problem. They're strong, very strong, and they've got a mind of their own. Stallions typically don't like to be bridled, and they can get downright aggressive, especially if there are mares around. A stallion is hard to tame. If you want a safer, quieter animal, there's an easy solution. Castrate him. A gelding is much more compliant. You can lead him around by the nose. He'll do what he's told without putting up a fuss. There's only one problem. Geldings don't give life. They can't come through for you the way a stallion can. A stallion is dangerous, all right, but if you want the life he offers, you have to have the danger, too. They go together. Let's say it's June 6th, 1944, about 07:10. You are a soldier in the third wave onto Omaha Beach. Thousands of men have gone before you, and now it's your turn. As you jump out of the Higgins boat and wade to the beach, you see the bodies of fallen soldiers everywhere, floating in the water, tossing in the surf, lying on the beach. Moving up the sand, you encounter hundreds of wounded men. Some are limping toward the bluffs with you, looking for shelter. Others are barely crawling. Snipers on the cliffs above continue to take them out. Everywhere you look, there are pain and brokenness. The damage is almost overwhelming. When you reach the cliffs, the only point of safety, you find squads of men with no leader. They are shell-shocked, stunned, and frightened. Many have lost their weapons. Most of them refuse to move. They are paralyzed with fear. Taking all this in, what would you conclude? What would be your assessment of the situation? Whatever else went through your mind, you'd have to admit, this is one brutal war, and no one would have disagreed or thought you odd for having said so. But we do not think so clearly about life, and I'm not sure why. Have a look around you. What do you observe? What do you see in the lives of men that you work with, live by, go to church alongside? Are they full of passionate freedom? Do they fight well? Are their women deeply grateful for how well their men have loved them? Are their children radiant with affirmation? The idea is almost laughable if it weren't so tragic. Men have been taken out left and right. Scattered across the neighborhood lie the shattered lives of men and women who have died at a soul level from the wounds they've taken. You've heard the expression, he's a shell of a man? They have lost heart. Many more are alive, but badly wounded. They are trying to crawl forward, but are having an awful time getting their lives together. They seem to keep taking hits. You know others who are already captives, languishing in prisons of despair, addiction, idleness, or boredom. The place looks like a battlefield, the Omaha Beach of the soul. That is precisely what it is. We are now in the late stages of the long and vicious war against the human heart. I know, it sounds overly dramatic. I almost didn't use the term war at all, for fear of being dismissed at this point as one more in the group of Chicken Littles, Christians who run around trying to get everybody worked up over some imaginary fear in order to advance their political or economic or theological cause. But I am not hawking fear at all. I am speaking honestly about the nature of what is unfolding around us, against us. And until we call the situation what it is, we will not know what to do about it. In fact, this is where many people feel abandoned or betrayed by God. They thought that becoming a Christian would somehow end their troubles, or at least reduce them considerably. No one ever told them they were being moved to the front lines, and they seem genuinely shocked at the fact that they've been shot at. After the Allies took the beachhead at Normandy, the war wasn't over. In some ways, it had just begun. Stephen Ambrose has given us many unforgettable stories of what followed that famous landing in Citizen Soldiers, his record of how the Allies won the war. Many of those stories are almost parables in their meaning. Here is one that followed on the heels of D-Day. It is June 7th, 1944. Brigadier General Norman Dutch Cota, Assistant Division Commander of the 29th, came on a group of infantry pinned down by some Germans in a farmhouse. He asked the captain in command why his men were making no effort to take the building. "Sir, the Germans are in there, shooting at us," the captain replied. "Well, I tell you what, captain," said Cota, unbuckling two grenades from his jacket. "You and your men start shooting at them. I'll take a squad of men, and you and your men watch carefully. I'll show you how to take a house with Germans in it." Cota led his squad around a hedge to get as close as possible to the house. Suddenly, he gave a whoop and raced forward, the squad following, yelling like wild men. As they tossed grenades into the windows, Cota and another man kicked in the front door, tossed a couple of grenades inside, waited for the explosion, then dashed into the house. The surviving Germans inside were streaming out the back door, running for their lives. Cota returned to the captain. "You've seen how to take a house," said the general, still out of breath. "Do you understand? Do you know how to do it now?" "Yes, sir." What can we learn from the parable? Why were those guys pinned down? First, they seemed almost surprised that they were being shot at. "They're shooting at us, sir." "Hello, that's what happens in war. You get shot at. Have you forgotten? We were born into a world at war. This scene we're living in is no sitcom. It's bloody battle. Haven't you noticed with what deadly accuracy the wound was given? Those blows you've taken, they were not random accidents at all. They hit dead center. Charles was meant to be a pianist, but he never touched the piano again. I have a gift and a calling to speak into the hearts of men and women, but my wound tempted me to be a loner, live far from my heart and from others. Craig's calling is to preach the gospel, like his father and great-grandfather. His wound was an attempt to take that out. He's a seagull, remember? All he can do is squawk. I failed to mention Reggie earlier. His dad wounded him when he tried to excel in school. You are so stupid, you'll never make it through college. He wanted to be a doctor, but he never followed his dream. On and on it goes. The wound is too well aimed and far too consistent to be accidental. It was an attempt to take you out, to cripple or destroy your strength and get you out of the action. The wounds we've taken were leveled against us with stunning accuracy. Hopefully you're getting the picture. Do you know why there's been such an assault? The enemy fears you. You are dangerous, big time. If you ever really got your heart back, lived from it with courage, you would be a huge problem to him. You would do a lot of damage on the side of good. Remember how valiant and effective God has been in the history of the world? You are a stem of that victorious stock. Let me come back to the second lesson of the parable from D-Day plus one. The other reason those men were lying there, pinned down, unable to move, is because no one had ever shown them how to take a house before. They had been trained, but not for that. Most men have never been initiated into manhood. They have never had anyone show them how to do it, and especially how to fight for their heart. The failure of so many fathers, the emasculating culture, and the passive church have left men without direction. That is why I've written this book. I am here to tell you that you can get your heart back. But I need to warn you, if you want your heart back, if you want the wound healed and your strength restored and to find your true name, you're going to have to fight for it. Notice your reaction to my words. Does not something in you stir a little, a yearning to live? And doesn't another voice rush in, urging caution, maybe wanting to dismiss me altogether? He's being melodramatic. What arrogance. Or maybe some guys could, but not me. Or, I don't know, is this really worth it? That's part of the battle, right there. See, I'm not making this up. First and foremost, we still need to know what we never heard or heard so badly from our fathers. We need to know who we are and if we have what it takes. What do we do now with that ultimate question? Where do we go to find an answer? In order to help you find the answer to the question, let me ask you another. What have you done with your question? Where have you taken it? You see, a man's core question does not go away. He may try for years to shove it out of his awareness and just get on with his life, but it does not go away. It is a hunger so essential to our souls that it will compel us to find a resolution. In truth, it drives everything we do. I spent a few days this fall with a very successful man I'll call Peter. He was hosting me for a conference on the East Coast, and when Peter picked me up at the airport, he was driving a new Land Rover with all the bells and whistles. Nice car, I thought. This guy is doing well. The next day, we drove around in his BMW 850 CSI. Peter lived in the largest house in town and had a vacation home in Portugal. None of this wealth was inherited. He worked for every dime. He loved Formula One racing and fly fishing for salmon in Nova Scotia. I genuinely liked him. Now here's a man, I said to myself. And yet, there was something missing. You'd think a guy like this would be confident, self-assured, and centered. And of course, he seemed like that at first. But as we spent time together, I found him to be hesitant. He had all the appearances of masculinity, but none of it felt like it was coming from a true center. After several hours of conversation, he admitted he was coming to a revelation. I lost my father earlier this year to cancer, but I did not cry when he died. You see, we were never really close. Ah, yes, I knew what was coming next. All these years, knocking myself out to get ahead. I wasn't even enjoying myself. What was it for? I see now. I was trying to win my father's approval. A long, sad silence. Then Peter said quietly, through tears, "It never worked." Of course not. It never does. No matter how much you make, no matter how far you go in life, that will never heal your wound or tell you who you are. But oh, how many men buy into this one? After years of trying to succeed in the world's eyes, a friend still clings stubbornly to that idea. Sitting in my office, bleeding from all his wounds, he says to me, "Who's the real stud? The guy making money. You understand that he's not making much, so he can still chase the illusion." Men take their soul's search for validation in all sorts of directions. Brad is a good man who for so many years now has been searching for a sense of significance through belonging. As he said, out of my wounds, I figured out how to get life. I'll find a group to belong to, do something incredible that others will want, and I'll be somebody. First, it was the right gang of kids in school. Then it was the wrestling team. Years later, it was the right ministry team. It has been a desperate search by his own admission, and it hasn't gone well. When things didn't work out earlier this year at the ministry he was serving, he knew he had to leave. My heart has burst and all the wounds and arrows have come pouring out. I have never felt such pain. The sentences scream at me. I do not belong. I am wanted by no one. I am alone. Where does a man go for a sense of validation? To what he owns? To who pays attention to him? How attractive his wife is? Where he gets to eat out? How well he plays sports? The world cheers the vain search on. Make a million. Run for office. Get a promotion. Hit a home run. Be somebody. Can you feel the mockery of it all? The wounded crawl up the beach while the snipers fire away. But the deadliest place a man ever takes his search, the place every man seems to wind up, no matter what trail he's followed, is the woman. Remember the story of my first kiss, that little darling I fell in love with in the 7th grade, and how she made my bicycle fly? I fell in love with Debbie the very same year my father checked out of my story, the year I took my deepest wound. The timing was no coincidence. In a young boy's development, there comes a crucial time when the father must intervene. It arrives early in adolescence, somewhere between the ages of 11 and 15, depending on the boy. If that intervention does not happen, the boy is set up for disaster. The next window that opens in his soul is sexuality. Debbie made me feel like $1 million. I couldn't have put it into words at the time. I had no idea what was really going on. But in my heart, I felt I had found the answer to my question. A pretty girl thinks I'm the greatest. What more can a guy ask for? If I've found Juliet, then I must be Romeo. When she broke up with me, it began what has been a long and sad story of searching for the woman that will make me feel like a man. I went from girlfriend to girlfriend trying to get an answer, to be the hero to the beauty. That has been my longing, my image of what it means to really, finally be a man. Bly calls it the search for the golden-haired woman. He sees a woman across the room, knows immediately that it is she. He drops the relationship he has, pursues her, feels wild excitement, passion, beating heart, obsession. After a few months, everything collapses. She becomes an ordinary woman. He is confused and puzzled. Then he sees once more a radiant face across the room, and the old certainty comes again. Why is pornography the most addictive thing in the universe for men? Certainly, there's the fact that a man is visually wired, that pictures and images arouse men much more than they do women. But the deeper reason is because that seductive beauty reaches down inside and touches your desperate hunger for validation as a man you didn't even know you had. Touches it like nothing else most men have ever experienced. You must understand, this is deeper than legs and breasts and good sex. It is mythological. Look at the lengths men will go to find the golden-haired woman. They have fought duels over her beauty. They have fought wars. You see, every man remembers Eve. We are haunted by her. And somehow, we believe that if we could find her, get her back, then we'd also recover with her our own lost masculinity. You'll recall the little boy, Philip, from the movie A Perfect World. Remember what his fear was? That his penis was puny. That's how many men articulate a sense of emasculation. Later in life, a man's worst fear is often impotence. If he can't get an erection, then he hasn't got what it takes. But the opposite is also at work. If a man can feel an erection, well, then he feels powerful. He feels strong. I'm telling you, for many men, the question feels hardwired to his penis. If he can feel like the hero sexually, well then, mister, he's the hero. Pornography is so seductive because what is a wounded, famished man to think when there are literally hundreds of beauties willing to give themselves to him? Of course, it's not just to him, but when he's alone with the photos, it feels like it's just for him. It's unbelievable how many movies center around this lie. Get the beauty, win her, bed her, and you're the man. You're James Bond. You're a stud. Look carefully at the lyrics to Bruce Springsteen's song, Secret Garden, from his greatest hits recording in 1995. She'll let you in her house if you come knocking late at night. She'll let you in her mouth if the words you say are right. If you pay the price, she'll let you deep inside. But there's a secret garden she hides. She'll lead you down a path. There'll be tenderness in the air. She'll let you come just far enough so you know she's really there. She'll look at you and smile, and her eyes will say, she's got a secret garden where everything you want, where everything you need will always stay a million miles away. It's a deep lie wedded to a deep truth. Eve is a garden of delight, but she's not everything you want, everything you need, not even close. Of course, it will stay a million miles away. You can't get there from here because it's not there. It's not there. The answer to your question can never, ever be found there. Don't get me wrong. A woman is a captivating thing, more captivating than anything else in all creation. The naked woman's body is a portion of eternity too great for the eye of man. Femininity can arouse masculinity. Boy, oh boy, can it. My wife flashes me a little breast, a little thigh, and I'm ready for action. All systems alert. She tells me in a soft voice that I'm a man, and I'll leap tall buildings for her. But femininity can never bestow masculinity. It's like asking a pearl to give you a buffalo. It's like asking a field of wildflowers to give you a 57 Chevy. They are different substances entirely. When a man takes his question to the woman, what happens is either addiction or emasculation, usually both. Dave, whose father blew a hole in his chest when he called him Mama's boy, took his question to the woman. Recently, he confessed to me that younger women are his obsession. You can see why. They're less of a threat. A younger woman isn't half the challenge. He can feel more like a man there. Dave's embarrassed by his obsession, but it doesn't stop him. A younger woman feels like the answer to his question, and he's got to get an answer. But he knows his search is impossible. He admitted to me just the other day, even if I marry a beautiful woman, I will always know there's an even more beautiful woman out there somewhere. So I'll wonder, could I have won her? It's a lie. As Bly says, it's a search without an end. We are looking at the source of a lot of desperation in certain men here, and a lot of suffering in certain women. How often I have seen this. A friend's brother hit rock bottom a few years back when his girlfriend broke up with him. He was a really successful guy, a high school star athlete who became a promising young attorney. But he was carrying a wound from an alcoholic, workaholic father who never gave him what every boy craves. Like so many of us, he took his heart with its question to the woman. When she dumped him, my friend said, it blew him out of the water. He went into a major nosedive, started drinking heavily, smoking. He even left the country. His life was shattered. This is why so many men secretly fear their wives. She sees him as no one else does, sleeps with him, knows what he's made of. If he has given her the power to validate him as a man, then he has also given her the power to invalidate him too. That's the deadly catch. A pastor told me that for years he's been trying to please his wife, and she keeps giving him an F. What if she is not the report card on you, I suggested. She sure feels like it, and I'm failing. Another man, Richard, became verbally abusive toward his wife in the early years of their marriage. His vision for his life was that he was meant to be Romeo, and therefore she must be Juliet. So when she turned out to not be the golden-haired woman, he was furious. Because that meant, you see, that he was not the heroic man. I remember seeing a picture of Julia Roberts without costume and makeup. Oh, I realized, she's just an ordinary woman. He was coming to me for his validation, a young woman told me about the man she was dating, or had been dating. She was drawn to him at first, and certainly drawn to the way he was taken with her. That's why I broke up with him. I was amazed at her perceptiveness and her courage. It's very rare to find, especially in younger women. How wonderful it feels at first to be his obsession. To be thought of as a goddess is pretty heady stuff. But eventually, it all turns from romance to immense pressure on her part. He kept saying, I don't know if I have what it takes, and you're telling me I don't. He'll thank me for it someday. What's fascinating to note is that homosexuals are actually more clear on this point. They know that what is missing in their hearts is masculine love. The problem is that they've sexualized it. Joseph Nicolosi says that homosexuality is an attempt to repair the wound by filling it with masculinity, either the masculine love that was missing or the masculine strength many men feel they do not possess. It, too, is a vain search, and that is why the overwhelming number of homosexual relationships do not last, why so many gay men move from one man to another, and why so many of them suffer from depression and a host of other addictions. What they need can't be found there. Why have I said all this about our search for validation and the answer to our question? Because we cannot hear the real answer until we see we've got a false one. So long as we chase the illusion, how can we face reality? The hunger is there. It lives on our souls like a famished craving, no matter what we've tried to fill it with. If you take your question to Eve, it will break your heart. I know this now after many, many hard years. You can't get your answer there. In fact, you can't get your answer from any of the things men chase after to find their sense of self. There is only one source for the answer to your question. And so no matter where you've taken your question, you've got to take it back. You have to walk away. That is the beginning of your journey. Chapter 6. The Father's Voice. No man, for any considerable period of time, can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the truth. Nathaniel Hawthorne. Esse quam videri. To be rather than to appear. Who can give a man this, his own name? George MacDonald. Summers in the eastern Oregon sagebrush are hot, dry, and dusty. When the sun was high, the temperature could soar into the 90s, so whenever possible, we saved most of the hard labor on the ranch for the early morning or late afternoon and evening, when the cool air drifted up from the river valley below. Sometimes we'd fix irrigation ditches during the heat of the day, which for me was a great excuse to get really wet. I'd tromp along in the ditch, letting the warm, muddy water soak my jeans. But most of the time, we'd head back to the ranch house for a glass of iced tea. Pop loved his tea sweetened with a healthy dose of sugar, the way they drink it in the South. We'd sit at the kitchen table and have a glass or two and talk about the events of the morning or a plan he had to sell some cattle at the auction or how he thought we'd spend the afternoon. One day late in the summer of my 13th year, Pop and I had just come in for our ritual when he stood up and walked over to the window. The kitchen faced south and from there gave a view over a large alfalfa field and then on toward the pasture land. Like most ranchers, Pop grew his own hay to provide feed for cattle and horses he kept over the winter. I joined him at the window and saw that a steer had gotten out of the range and into the alfalfa. I remember my grandfather telling me that it's dangerous for a cow to stuff itself on fresh alfalfa. It expands in their stomach like rising bread and could rupture one of their four chambers. Pop was clearly irritated, as only a cowboy can be irritated at cattle. I, on the other hand, was excited. This meant adventure. "Go saddle up Tony and get that steer," he said, sitting back in his chair and kicking his boots up on the one in front of him. His demeanor made it clear that he was not going with me. He was, in fact, not going anywhere. As he poured himself another glass of tea, my mind raced through the implications of what he'd said. It meant I first had to go catch Tony, the biggest horse on the ranch. I was scared of Tony, but we both knew he was the best cattle horse. I had to saddle him up by myself and ride out to get that steer. Alone. Having processed this information, I realized I had been standing there for who knows how long, and it was time I got going. As I walked out the back porch toward the corral, I felt two things and felt them strongly. Fear and honor. Most of our life-changing moments are realized as such later. I couldn't have told you why, but I knew I'd crossed a threshold in my life as a young man. Pop believed in me, and whatever he saw that I did not, the fact that he believed made me believe it too. I got the steer that day, and a whole lot more. A man needs to know his name. He needs to know he's got what it takes. And I don't mean know in the modernistic, rationalistic sense. I don't mean that the thought has passed through your cerebral cortex and you've given it intellectual assent, the way you know about the Battle of Waterloo or the ozone layer, the way most men know God or the truths of Christianity. I mean a deep knowing, the kind of knowing that comes when you have been there, entered in, experienced firsthand in an unforgettable way. The way Adam knew his wife, and she gave birth to a child. Adam didn't know about Eve. He knew her intimately, through flesh and blood experience at a very deep level. There's knowledge about and knowledge of. When it comes to our question, we need the latter. In the movie Gladiator, set in the 2nd century AD, the hero is a warrior from Spain called Maximus. He is the commander of the Roman armies, a general loved by his men and by the aging emperor Marcus Aurelius. The emperor's foul son Commodus learns of his father's plan to make Maximus emperor in his place. But before Marcus can pronounce his successor, Commodus strangles his father. He sentences Maximus to immediate execution and his wife and son to crucifixion and burning. Maximus escapes, but too late to save his family. Captured by slave traders, he is sold as a gladiator. That fate is normally a death sentence, but this is Maximus, a valiant fighter. He more than survives, he becomes a champion. Ultimately, he is taken to Rome to perform in the Colosseum before the Emperor Commodus, who of course believes that Maximus is long dead. After a remarkable display of courage and a stunning upset, the emperor comes down into the arena to meet the valiant gladiator, whose identity remains hidden behind his helmet. Commodus. Your fame is well deserved, Spaniard. I don't believe there's ever been a gladiator that matched you. Why doesn't the hero reveal himself and tell us all your real name? Maximus is silent. You do have a name. My name is Gladiator. He turns and walks away. How dare you show your back to me, slave? You will remove your helmet and tell me your name. Slowly, very slowly, lifts his helmet and turns to face his enemy. My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or in the next. His answer builds like a mighty wave, swelling in size and strength before it crashes on the shore. Where does a man go to learn an answer like that? To learn his true name, a name that can never be taken from him. That deep heart knowledge comes only through a process of initiation. You have to know where you've come from. You have to have faced a series of trials that test you. You have to have taken a journey, and you have to have faced your enemy. But as a young man recently lamented to me, I've been a Christian since I was 5. No one ever showed me what it means to really be a man. He's lost now. He moved across the country to be with his girlfriend, but she's dumped him because he doesn't know who he is and what he's here for. There are countless others like him, a world of such men, a world of uninitiated men. The church would like to think it is initiating men, but it's not. What does the church bring a man into? What does it call him out to be? Moral. That is pitifully insufficient. Morality is a good thing, but morality is never the point. Paul says the law is given as a tutor to the child, but not to the son. The son is invited up into something much more. He gets the keys to the car. He gets to go away with the father on some dangerous mission. I'm struck by the poignancy of the scene at the end of the Civil War, just after Appomattox, where General Robert E. Lee has surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant. For 5 years, Lee has led the Army of Northern Virginia through some of the most terrible trials men have ever known. You would think they'd be glad to have it over. But Lee's men hang upon the reins of his horse and beg him not to go, plead for one more chance to whip those Yankees. Lee had become their father, had given those men what most of them had never had before, an identity and a place in a larger story. Every man needs to know someone like Robert E. Lee, or that Brigadier General from the 29th. You've seen how to take a house? Do you understand? Do you know how to do it now? Yes, sir. We need someone like my grandfather, who can teach us how to saddle up. But Lee is long gone. Brigadier Generals are rare. My grandfather has been dead for many years. Where do we go? To whom can we turn? To a most surprising source. A number of years ago, at a point in my own journey when I felt more lost than ever, I heard a talk given by Gordon Dalby, who had just written Healing the Masculine Soul. He raised the idea that despite a man's past and the failures of his own father to initiate him, God could take him on that journey, provide what was missing. A hope rose within me, but I dismissed it with the cynicism I'd learned to use to keep down most things in my soul. Several weeks, perhaps months later, I was downstairs in the early morning to read and pray. As with so many of my quiet times, I ended up looking out the window toward the east to watch the sunrise. I heard Jesus whisper a question to me. Will you let me initiate you? Before my mind ever had a chance to process, dissect, and doubt the whole exchange, my heart leaped up and said yes. Who can give a man this, his own name? George MacDonald asks. God alone, for no one but God sees what the man is. He reflects upon the white stone that Revelation includes among the rewards God will give to those who overcome. On that white stone, there is a new name. It is new only in the sense that it is not the name the world gave to us, certainly not the one delivered with the wound. No man will find on that stone Mama's Boy or Fatty or Seagull. But the new name is really not new at all when you understand that it is your true name, the one that belongs to you, that being whom he had in his thought when he began to make the child, and whom he kept in his thought throughout the long process of creation and redemption. Psalm 139 makes it clear that we were personally, uniquely planned and created, knit together in our mother's womb by God himself. He had someone in mind, and that someone has a name. That someone has also undergone a terrible assault, and yet God remains committed to the realization of that same someone. The giving of the white stone makes it clear that is what he is up to. The history of a man's relationship with God is the story of how God calls him out, takes him on a journey, and gives him his true name. Most of us have thought it was the story of how God sits on his throne, waiting to whack a man broadside when he steps out of line. Not so. He created Adam for adventure, battle, and beauty. He created us for a unique place in his story and is committed to bringing us back to the original design. So God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees to a land he has never seen, to the frontier. And along the way, Abram gets a new name. He becomes Abraham. God takes Jacob off into Mesopotamia somewhere to learn things he has to learn and cannot learn at his mother's side. When he rides back into town, he has a limp and a new name as well. Even if your father did his job, he can only take you part way. There comes a time when you have to leave all that is familiar and go into the unknown with God. Saul was a guy who really thought he understood the story and very much liked the part he had written for himself. He was the hero of his own little mini-series, Saul the Avenger. After that little matter on the Damascus Road, he becomes Paul. And rather than heading back into all the old and familiar ways, he is led out into Arabia for 3 years to learn directly from God. Jesus shows that initiation can happen even when we've lost our father or grandfather. He's the carpenter's son, which means Joseph was able to help him in the early days of his journey. But when we meet the young man, Jesus, Joseph is out of the picture. Jesus has a new teacher, his true father, and it is from him he must learn who he really is and what he's really made of. Initiation involves a journey and a series of tests through which we discover our real name and our true place in the story. Robert Rourke's book, The Old Man and the Boy, is a classic example of this kind of relationship. There's a boy who needs a lot of teaching, and there's an old man who's got a lot of wisdom. But the initiation doesn't take place at a school desk. It takes place in the field, where simple lessons about the land and animals and seasons turn into larger lessons about life and self and God. Through each test comes a revelation. The boy must keep his eyes open and ask the right questions. Learning to hunt quail helps you learn about yourself. He's smart as a whip, and every time you go up against him, you're proving something about yourself. Most of us have been misinterpreting life and what God is doing for a long time. I think I'm just trying to get God to make my life work easier, a client of mine confessed, but he could have been speaking for most of us. We're asking the wrong questions. Most of us are asking, God, why did you let this happen to me? Or, God, why don't you just fill in the blank, help me succeed, get my kids straightened out, fix my marriage? You know what you've been whining about. But to enter into a journey of initiation with God requires a new set of questions. What are you trying to teach me here? What issues in my heart are you trying to raise through this? What is it you want me to see? What are you asking me to let go of? In truth, God has been trying to initiate you for a long time. What is in the way is how you've mishandled your wound and the life you've constructed as a result. Men are taught over and over when they are boys that a wound that hurts is shameful, notes Bly. A wound that stops you from continuing to play is a girlish wound. He who is truly a man keeps walking, dragging his guts behind. Like a man who's broken his leg in a marathon, he finishes the race even if he has to crawl and he doesn't say a word about it. That sort of misunderstanding is why, for most of us, our wound is an immense source of shame. A man's not supposed to get hurt. He's certainly not supposed to let it really matter. We've seen too many movies where the good guy takes an arrow, just breaks it off, and keeps on fighting. Or maybe he gets shot, but is still able to leap across a canyon and get the bad guys. And so most men minimize their wound. It's not a big deal. Lots of people get hurt when they're young. I'm okay. King David, a guy who's hardly a pushover, doesn't act like that at all. I am poor and needy, he confesses openly, and my heart is wounded within me. Psalm 109:22. Or perhaps they'll admit it happened, but deny it was a wound because they deserved it. After many months of counseling together about his wound, his vow, and how it was impossible to get the answer from women, I asked David a simple question. What would it take to convince you that you are a man? Nothing, he said. Nothing can convince me. We sat in silence as tears ran down my cheeks. You've embraced the wound, haven't you, Dave? You've owned its message as final. You think your father was right about you. Yes, he said, without any sign of emotion at all. I went home and wept. For Dave, and for so many other men I know, and for myself, because I realized that I, too, had embraced my wound, and ever since, just tried to get on with life. Suck it up, as the saying goes. The only thing more tragic than the tragedy that happens to us is the way we handle it. God is fiercely committed to you, to the restoration and release of your masculine heart. But a wound that goes unacknowledged and unwept is a wound that cannot heal. A wound you've embraced is a wound that cannot heal. A wound you think you deserved is a wound that you cannot heal. That is why Brennan Manning says, "The spiritual life begins with the acceptance of our wounded self." Really? How can that be? The reason is simple. Whatever is denied cannot be healed. But that's the problem, you see. Most men deny their wound, deny that it happened, deny that it hurt, certainly deny that it's shaping the way they live today. And so, God's initiation of a man must take a very cunning course, a course that feels very odd, even cruel. He will wound us in the very place where we have been wounded. From the place of our woundedness, we construct a false self. We find a few gifts that work for us, and we try to live off them. Stuart found he was good at math and science. He shut down his heart and spent all his energies perfecting his Spock persona. There, in the academy, he was safe. He was also recognized and rewarded. Alex was good at sports and the whole macho image. He became a glass-eating animal. Stan became the nicest guy you could ever meet. In the story of my life, he admitted, I want to be seen as the nice guy. I became a hard-charging perfectionist. There, in my perfection, I found safety and recognition. When I was 8, confesses Brennan Manning, the imposter or false self was born as a defense against pain. The imposter within whispered, Brennan, don't ever be your real self anymore because nobody likes you as you are. Invent a new self that everybody will admire and nobody will know. Notice the key phrase, as a defense against pain, as a way of saving himself. The imposter is our plan for salvation. So God must take it all away. This often happens at the start of our initiation journey. He thwarts our plan for salvation. He shatters the false self. In the last chapter, I told you of Brad's plan for self-redemption. He would belong to the inside group. Even after it failed him time and again, breaking his heart over and over, he wouldn't give it up. He simply thought his aim was off. If he found the right group, then his plan would work. Our plan for redemption is hard to let go of. It clings to our hearts like an octopus. So what did God do for Brad? He took it all away. God brought Brad to the point where he thought he had found the group, and then God prevented him from maneuvering his way in. Brad wrote me a letter to describe what he was going through. God has taken all that away, stripped me of all the things I used to earn people's admiration. I knew what he was up to. He put me in a place where my heart's deepest wounds and arrows and sin came out. As I was weeping, all these pictures of what I want to belong to came up, speaker, counselor, in a group. And it was as if Jesus asked me to give them up. What came from my heart was surprising, incredible fear. And then the image of never getting them. A sentence arose in my heart. You want me to die. If I give up those, I'll never belong and be somebody. You're asking me to die. It has been my hope of salvation. Why would God do something so cruel? Why would he do something so terrible as to wound us in the place of our deepest wound? Jesus warned us that whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Christ is not using the word bios here. He's not talking about our physical life. The passage is not about trying to save your skin by ducking martyrdom or something like that. The word Christ uses for life is the word psyche, the word for our soul, our inner self, our heart. He says that the things we do to save our psyche, our self, those plans to save and protect our inner life, those are the things that will actually destroy us. There's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death, says Proverbs 16:25. The false self, our plan for redemption, seems so right to us. It shields us from pain and secures us a little love and admiration. But the false self is a lie. The whole plan is built on pretense. It's a deadly trap. God loves us too much to leave us there, so he thwarts us in many, many different ways. In order to take a man into his wound, so that he can heal it and begin the release of the true self, God will thwart the false self. He will take away all you've leaned upon to bring you life. In the movie The Natural, Robert Redford is a baseball player named Roy Hobbs, perhaps the most gifted baseball player ever. He's a high school wonder boy, a natural who gets a shot at the big leagues. But his dreams of a professional career are cut short when Hobbs is wrongly sentenced to prison for murder. Years later, an aging Hobbs gets a second chance. He's signed by the New York Knights, the worst team in the league. But through his incredible gift, untarnished by the years, Hobbs leads the Knights from ignominy to the playoff game for the National League pennant. He rallies the team, becomes the center of their hopes and dreams. The climax of the film is the game for the championship. It's the bottom of the ninth. The score is Pittsburgh 2, Knights 0. The Knights have two outs. There's a man on first and third when Hobbs steps up to the plate. He's their only chance. This is his moment. Now, there's something you must know, something absolutely crucial to the story. Ever since his high school days, Hobbs has played with a bat he made himself from the heart of a tree felled by lightning in his front yard. Burned into the bat is a lightning bolt and the words, Wonder Boy. The bat is the symbol of his greatness, his giftedness. He has never, ever played with another. Clutching Wonder Boy, Hobbs steps up to the plate. His first swing is a miss. His second is a foul ball high and behind. His third is a solid hit along the first base line. It looks like a home run, but it also lands foul. As Hobbs returns to the plate, he sees his bat lying there, in pieces. It shattered on that last swing. This is the critical moment in a man's life, when all he has counted on comes crashing down, when his golden bat breaks into pieces. His investments fail, his company lets him go, the church fires him. He is leveled by an illness, his wife walks out, his daughter turns up pregnant. What is he to do? Will he stay in the game? Will he shrink back to the dugout? Will he scramble to try to put things back together as so many men do? The true test of a man, the beginning of his redemption, actually starts when he can no longer rely on what he's used all his life. The real journey begins when the false self fails. A moment that seems like an eternity passes as Hobbs stands there, holding the broken pieces, surveying the damage. The bat is beyond repair. Then he says to the bat boy, "Go pick me out a winner, Bobby." He stays in the game and hits a home run to win the series. God will take away our bat as well. He will do something to thwart the false